something new. From up here can't beat the view. Just watch me now. Welcome to the Hockey Show here on 101.5 UMFM, Canada's only campus-produced radio show that strictly talks hockey. Glad to have you along, everybody. Glad to have you with us tonight. Got another great guest tonight. Actually, a topic I know very little about, and I am ashamed to say this because I have a fairly robust jersey collection, but I have no idea on anything as to pricing, what they'd be worth, anything like that. And I'm going to bring in a guy who does because he knows way more than me. So let's get with this. Let's get going on this. How much would you be willing to pay for a piece of sports history? $10,000, maybe $1 million. Plenty of hockey fans and some serious collectors are always willing to splash some cash to buy merchandise and memorabilia ranging from game-worn hockey sweaters to rare trading cards. Sometimes it's with a piece of art, an iconic item of sports memorabilia is a sound investment. It's almost sure to appreciate in value. Have you ever wondered how you get into the game and join those who deal in verified game-used equipment? Because I know I have no idea how to do that. Tonight, though, the Hockey Show is proud, honored, privileged, humbled, and pleased to welcome one of the people who has made a name for himself locally as he joined the game-worn jersey scene a few years ago. He's made deals, sold items, and put through the ringer when it comes to ensuring that the jerseys he's buying and selling are indeed game-worn. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hockey Show is pleased to welcome back to the show Mr. Stu Eckert. Stu, how are you?
Hey, very well. Thanks for having me on. This is great.
No, we're glad to have you on. Like I said, this is one topic that I've never really thought about more than, hey, I kind of want that jersey, or hey, that's a cool-looking jersey. I should see if I can find one or whatever. So before we get started, let's start in the present time. How's everything going, Stu? How's everything with you? Everybody safe on your side?
Yeah, everything's good. We've been living COVID. The kids are at home with doing the online schooling and as well as they could do with that. And my wife's a teacher, so she's been working. I'm an essential worker, so we've been good. Just the summer travel plans are kind of in disarray. Don't know where to go or what to do. So that's kind of everyone's boat, right?
Yeah. The summer vacation may have taken a bit of a detour at this point. That's
yeah,
no
for
doubt.
Sure.
Yeah. So let's get into this because you're a guy that knows a ton about this, and I know nothing. So I want to make sure I pick your brain as much as possible here.
Sure.
Honestly. I don't know anything about this. I know how it's done. I know that you can go to auction sites. I know that you can get some information and certainly get everything going. But how did you get started in this hobby, Stu? Because it's not something that, I mean, it seems like it's not something that somebody can pick up right out of, you know, just off the street and start going, I want to do that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. I went in 1998 with a couple of buddies. One was a huge Flyers fan. And we went down to, through Ontario, and we went to a game in Philadelphia. We went to a Flyers game, and it was fun. We went to a Phantoms game with the Spectrum beforehand, and the Flyers game on the next day.
Nice.
And he had written a letter to Ed Snyder, a big, what I call a bit of a suck-up letter, saying how much he loves the Flyers, blah, blah, blah. So Ed Snyder writes him back and says, if you're ever in Philadelphia, come on down. We'll get you in the locker room. And his kid's like, wow, I can't believe that's in the locker room. So we're at the game. He's got he's wearing to the game a game-worn Dave the Hammer Schultz from 1975. So we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah.
But he says, the third period's come up. He says, Stu, they haven't called me down. Like, I don't know what's going on. I says, I'll go find out. So I found someone who looked like they were an official at the Flyers game. I says, I got a buddy who got a letter from Ed Snyder. He's supposed to be coming down. Oh, we'll get on that right away, sir. Yeah, we were coming to get him. So I says to my buddy, I says, I think they're coming to get you. He says, I'll tell you what, if they actually come get me, I'm going to give you my Tiger Williams jersey. I'm like, okay, well, whatever. I just didn't think anything of it. So sure enough, he got called down to the dressing room. He met with Lindros and a few others. It was great. He loved it. And he gave me this Tiger Williams jersey. So I thought, wow, this is kind of cool. He goes, I'm not sure if it's game worn or what it is, but it's part of my collection. So I got this. So in 1998, I got my first jersey. And then I kind of got hooked, right? I started looking at, because this Tiger Williams jersey was the ugly one. You remember the ones with they had in the 70s with the V? It was the dark with the fleet. Like, it was, what were they thinking, right? What was Vancouver thinking? So he gave me this. I had no idea what the value is. So I kind of started looking at game worn stuff. This is kind of before a lot of the stuff was online, so you had to look through, you know, the hockey news. The back of the hockey news always had ads for game worn stuff, and it was super cheap then. So fast forward a few years, I've acquired many jerseys, some game worn, some game issued, and have recently bought and sold, and I've had a lot of fun with it.
I mean, that's the thing. I think the tough part is being knowledgeable in what to look for, right? And I mean, you said, you know, obviously starting with the hockey news and keeping an eye on, you know, what some of those guys have and what they were advertising. Correct. And that kind of stuff. You have to really know what to look for in a jersey if you're going to get into the game, so to speak. How do you know that a jersey is game worn? What do you look for? How do you authenticate that? Like, what's your process when somebody says, "Hey, man, I got this jersey. Can you check it out?"
Well, you know, I thank you for saying how knowledgeable I am. I'm really not as knowledgeable as some. I'm only about halfway there because okay. some of these guys get right into the minutia of it. I'm telling you, they know what type of thread was used to put the patching on. I had a jersey with a trainer's name in it, and they go, "Oh yeah, I know. I remember that trainer for the Islanders." And I'm like, "Really? You know the? Oh yeah, you got to know all the trainers' names because if they sign it, you have to make sure it was their signature." I'm like, "Wow." This guy had a database of all the trainers' signatures so he could authenticate it. Like it got deep. Like it got, wow. Like, you know, I'm still a guy who, when I buy something, I'm like, okay, I'm going to need a letter of authenticity with that or else I'm not going to buy it. But right, I had some guys buy some stuff off me recently. I had an old Steve Weeks Vancouver and a Trevor Kidd Calgary, his rookie jersey.
Okay.
And I showed it to him. He goes, "Yeah, I'll take them." I go, "Well, I don't have letters of authenticity." He goes, "It's okay. I can tell." I'm like, "Really? You really can?" He goes, "Oh yeah, I can tell." I says, "How?" I says, "I looked at the numbering. I looked at the spacing between the letters on the back. I looked at all that. I looked at the threads, the type of material it was. Just by me sending pictures, I'm pretty confident not only that these are game worn, but I think I can get them photo matched too." Now, before I expand on that, photo matched is the ultimate authenticity. If you can actually have a mark on a white jersey of a puck, and you can show that on a hockey card or the image Getty Images on internet, then you're gold. That's the ultimate. But other than that, The real high standard is MyGray. MyGray does a lot of the authentication for all the jerseys. They sell for a lot of teams. And if it's got a MyGray stamp, I even bought one without a letter of authenticity. It just has the MyGray patch inside the jersey, and it's gold. So that's kind of the high end. And so they're kind of the go-to people for authentication in the States.
I'm glad you brought up MyGray because I was going to ask about them as well. Them Classic Auctions, who seems to do a lot of work in terms of making sure there's, you know, letters of authenticity and certification on them. Those seem to be two of the best on the internet when it comes to looking for, you know, for game worn stuff.
Yes.
I mean, again, not that I'm going to throw you under the bus here, but the problem it seems with those two sites anyway, is that the hobby's kind of pricey for a lot of people maybe looking to get into it. How does one get into the hobby of buying and selling game worn gear if the entry point is kind of beyond one's means?
Oh, well, you know, really, you can go on eBay. If you go on ebay.ca, you're dealing in Canadian dollars. This is another thing about the game worn hockey industry. It's all in American dollars. Even Classic Auctions, they do all their transactions in US funds.
Yeah.
And let me give you an idea of what you're up against if you're bidding on something with Classic Auctions. So you have, let's say you're the winner and it's $500. So you got $500 US. So now you have to calculate that Canadian. Then you have to times that by 1.20 because there's the buyer's amount is 20%.
Right, yeah.
So you have to add 20% of that. Plus you have to pay another probably $40-$50 American for shipping. So it's very, very pricey. The price you see that you think you got it for, if you transfer to Canadian funds, is a lot more. So you want to be careful. But you can get, if you want to get a game-worn jersey, you can still get something for $150-$200 Canadian. It's probably going to be a no-name player. It's probably going to be someone who maybe played, you know, half a season in the league, didn't do much, and it's a pretty main mainline team, and there's nothing unique about it. There's no patching. There's nothing unique about the jersey, and you can get into the market. Again, it may not go up in value. So often, what guys do when they're collecting, they'll collect either a certain player or there's a collect for a certain patch. The patching really makes it go up. I mean, and you've seen the patching on NHL jerseys over the years.
Yeah.
There was the Colorado had the Columbine patch. Any team that goes to the Stanley Cup Finals has a Stanley Cup patch. A team's anniversary will have a patch. So if you collect with the patches, these things really, really kind of exponentially go up in value if it's a player that's well known. Let me give you an example. On the online site today, I saw that Tim Hunter himself is selling his game-worn jersey from the 1989 Stanley Cup Finals and has a Stanley Cup Finals patch on it. He says, "Don't even come to the door unless you have $10,500 US, because I won't entertain a bid from you."
Whoa.
So that's like what's that, 13.5 Canadian. So this is big dollars.
That is very big. I mean that's a new car in some cases.
It is indeed, yes. Or many, many mortgage payments.
I'm glad you brought up a little bit about trying to, you know, authenticate and look at it. It seems like the three major criteria for jerseys price, if I was going through and trying to figure out, you know, who's worth what and how much, what's the difference between jerseys, everything like that. It seems that the three main criteria are wear and tear on the jersey when it comes to authenticating when it was worn.
Correct.
Like you said, patches and spots or marks on the jersey certainly help. The celebrity of the player, as you were just alluding to, you know, bigger the player, the bigger the money. And the rarity of the jersey, either via the player's age or how uncommon the jersey is. And like you said, with the patches, it becomes even more in terms of, you know, rarity and how often they wore it.
Correct.
Are those the three main things you look at when you're looking for your purchase? Or are there other things that maybe you're like, I know how to sort of work the market a little bit to get a better price on that?
I like to buy things that I know will have a rarity. So I, right now in my collection, I'm going after third jerseys.
Okay.
So I've got the Dallas third jersey that had the colorful set of horns on it.
Yes.
I've got the Islanders jersey, the Fisherman one that they had out in 95. I've got the an old Coyotes from their first year. I've got the Bruins with the bear. I've got an Atlanta Thrashers that has Atlanta down the sleeves.
Yeah, the blue, yeah.
I picked up a Florida Panthers jersey, an older one, because I think they're going to be a team that's going to go bye-bye someday. I've got the Vancouver Millionaires outside game from 2013.
Okay, yeah.
That's kind of a select, and I got a Buffalo Slug. I just got that last week. The Buffalo jersey with the picture of the slug on it that everyone hated.
So yeah, yeah.
I kind of go, because what happened is that I kind of bought, 15 years ago, I bought these rare jerseys. I didn't pay much. I'll give you an example. I bought a Dana Murzyn jersey from the Canucks. It was the white one with the 20-year patch and the Canucks Kids Place patch on it. Very unique patches. And I paid $200 Canadian for that in 2005. And that jersey I just sold 3 weeks ago for $1,100 Canadian. So nice. There's some money. There's some, and this guy was like happy to pay that. He couldn't wait to have this. He thought it was a, are you sure? This is kind of a bargain. Like, I'm so happy to get this. So that's a pretty good markup. The other one I mentioned about my Islanders with Captain Highliner on it, that was only used for half a season. This is a game-issued minor leaguer I have on this. And one of the guys on the hockey forum said, don't let that go for under $1,500 US. And I paid $100 for that in 2003 in Winnipeg. So there's if you're collecting the right jerseys and you're willing to hang on to it for a while, you can make some money.
Okay, I got to ask you, because I'm going to bring that up in a second. I also have a Fisherman, and I'll talk about that in a second. But I want to ask this, because I see this a lot on jerseys, and I despise it. I think it actually devalues a jersey. But do autographs on a jersey make them more or less valuable, in your opinion?
You know what? From I used to think so, and now most of the guys who have a large collections have ways of removing autographs. They do not want the autographs on.
See, and I always thought, like, that's how I look at it. I go, like, that's just, I mean, it's just going to fade anyway if it's out in the, you know, in the sun or out in the open or whatever.
Correct.
I don't think that autographs belong on jerseys, but I always thought, why are you charging more for something that I don't want on it?
Exactly. And I'm happy to say that of my 16 game worns I have right now, I have none of them have any autographs on them, which is great, because I just don't like the autographs.
When you go into and again, I'm not saying you go into, you know, team into arenas and start, you know, demanding to speak to the manager, you know, the team manager or anything like that, or team equipment manager or anything.
Yeah.
But do you ever go to like a team jersey sale or a team sale or whatever and just go, hey man, like, why are all these autographs? Like, could you have any without autographs? Because that's what I would be asking.
I try and stay away from the team sales because they really are, they're actually really expensive. If you go to a Jets game and they've got Jets stuff out there, like that's on sale, and it's really, really expensive. So yeah. I try and stay away from the team sales. I try and stay with the forums, guys who have jerseys who they've had for a long time, they've enjoyed, now they want to move it, make a bit of money on it. So go with those. I bought a few off of eBay. I bought a couple off of Classic Auctions when the dollar was better.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got, and I think I bought one off of GameWorn Auctions.com, which is another big one out of Florida.
Okay.
So, you know, it's trying to, and it's just trying to find, once you figure out what you want to collect, then you know what to go for. I don't want any mainstream. I like third jerseys. I like older jerseys. I like the stuff that's not going to be around anymore. That's kind of the stuff, that's my meat and potatoes. So, you know, I got a 2006 Camilleri Los Angeles with the old style. My next one that I want will be, you know, something else that's going to be an old style, an old Buffalo Sabres I wouldn't mind. So I try and stick with the stuff that's going to naturally get a rarity. Now, you mentioned something earlier that was very true until you hit a certain age of jersey. You said the celebrity of the player makes a big difference. That's true until you start getting into jerseys that were jerseys from when the league went to 12 teams in 67. Oh. Those jerseys, like the Kings and Oakland, California, Cleveland, Kansas City, Colorado.
Yeah.
Those are so rare. It doesn't matter whose name is on the back of it.
Yeah.
They're so rare. Like the one on Classic Auctions, there was a no-name person for Oakland Seals jersey, and it went for $13.5 US, and it's just, we don't even know who the guy was on it.
Well,
there was an auction
on there that ended last week, and there was a Colorado Rockies Sean Shanahan, who I've never heard about.
No, I know. Yes.
Who is this guy? $500 starting bid, but it ended at $3,400 American. And I'm going, this guy didn't even play a full season in the NHL, and his jersey's going for $3,400. Like, I get the rarity of it, and that's where, I mean, like I said, that one of those criteria is the rarity, but like $3,400 for a no name, and you can't, I mean, those names aren't coming off those jerseys. Like,
yeah,
those are impossible to find. I get the why it's going to be expensive, but who the heck is Sean Shanahan? That's what yeah. I was looking at.
And the Rockies existence from, you know, I can't remember what year, like 75 to 80 or something like that.
Yeah.
They crossed the plane of when they had names in the back, not names on the back, to having names on the back. So a lot of those jerseys that are pre 75 have no names on the back,
right,
which makes it kind of cool. But then again, there's also no name on the back, right? So it makes it a little bit, it can be tougher. So a lot of those older ones, I'd like to come across someone who's kind of maybe desperate and needs to sell because they're hard to come by and they're very expensive. I also want to pick up an old North Stars as well. The green North Stars. Beautiful. Yeah. It's a beautiful jersey, right?
Yes.
But
looking at the older jerseys though, Stu, I mean, this is where I sort of get the question of authenticity now, because I mean, now, and I've got a couple of jerseys that have the patch on the inside of the bottom hem where the trainer signs off on it as being, you know, it's a game issue and that kind of stuff. The older jerseys don't have that. So, I mean, photos back then were rare in terms of just trying to get, you know, your favorite, or even not your favorite player, even just some no-name player on a picture. How Correct. Is it a lot harder to be able to authenticate though, like an older sweater, more or less, when they were still back using the sweater / early days of the jersey?
It is. It actually really is, because there's less pictures, right? And that's the problem. The quality pictures now of a modern day player, there's literally thousands of pictures.
Yeah.
But you don't get that from the guys who were playing for, you know, for Atlanta or Oakland. That just doesn't exist. So it's much harder.
Have you come across a situation where you've been like, I can't because I don't know?
Yes, and I have done that, and I usually err on the side of caution and not go for it.
Right.
Think about it. If you're spending a lot of money, and we're talking at one of those jerseys that are older like that, it could be thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
U.S. funds. Like, ooh, that's a big roll of dice if you don't have the proper LOA for it.
In your collection, here's a fun question for you, Stu. In your collection, What would you say is the jersey that you yourself prize the most? Like, what's the one that if you were like, it's going to take a lot to get that out of my hands if I have to sell it?
I would say probably the Islanders fisherman. It's such an odd jersey. There was such an uproar to it. They only had it half a year. And then basically the Islanders fans kind of revolted, like, get this out of here. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of the one that I really enjoy the most, and it would take a lot. And the Buffa slug too, the slug 2006 Buffalo yeah. jersey.
Yeah.
There was almost a revolt to that as well. And so they're kind of neat. They're odd. Right. So they'd be hard to get those ones out, but really any jersey has its price. So if someone comes along and offers me something and it's just, you know, they really, really want it and they're willing to put the money up, then it's going to go in the mail.
Well, and I mean, that's the thing, right? It's still a business at the end of the day. So
exactly.
I get that. Now, again, I was going to mention the fisherman. I have one. I have a fisherman that I bought. It wasn't game worn. It's not game issue, just bought, but it's got all the proper fixings on it. I have a Darius Kasparaitis fisherman jersey with
nice.
The 25th anniversary patch on the
yeah.
front and
yeah.
obviously the alternate captain. I just because I was goofing around or whatever, we were at a Gold Eyes game and the person I was with was wearing it because they were like, I need a cool jersey to wear for the hockey night and stuff that the Gold Eyes do. And we were offered $800 right there on the spot for it. I said no, obviously, because I mean, the fisherman is near and dear to my heart, but yeah. Would you have taken $800 right there on the spot if you had that jersey?
And that was a pro replica.
It's a professional with the like the fighting strap and everything in it. Yeah.
Professional replica with an autograph. Is that correct?
No autograph from Kasparaitis.
No autograph. No,
I don't do the autographs. I hate them.
Okay. So, yes, I would have taken $800 for that on the spot.
Oh, wow. So I made a bad deal. Taken...
Well, that's okay. That's okay. You don't know, right? You don't
know. And that's the thing.
I bought a couple jerseys early on in my collecting career that I thought, you know, I remember trading a laptop with this guy. I thought, oh, I got these jerseys are great. And they end up being just, they were kind of crappy. So, you know, it's, and you live and learn, right? But, you know, that going back to that, I had mentioned earlier about my friend having the 1975 Dave the Hammer Schultz
yeah.
jersey with all the DNA and blood on it, like easily photo matched. He had an open offer from a guy in Philadelphia, a lawyer in Philadelphia. He said, anytime you want to sell that, $50,000 US, no wow. problem. Yes. That's and to crazy. This day, he hasn't sold it, but that's the kind of, you know, with Dave the Hammer Schultz, he's a legend in Philly.
Yeah.
I think him and Williams were the leaders in penalty mills. I'm not sure if that still exists, but they were the leaders in their time. And he's just a legendary figure. So yeah, $50,000 US. Now we're talking not just a car. Now we're talking like a third of a house.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, most expensive, 2010 saw the most expensive jersey ever sold anywhere. The Paul Henderson Summit Series jersey that he Correct. Wore for games 4 to 8 sold
yes.
for $1.27 million. And I go,
yes.
that is an astronomical amount of money. But I guess, I mean, again, it's the rarity. It's the fact that it comes from Paul Henderson directly and you know where it's coming from. Like that's a ton of money for anybody to put out for, you know, $200 worth of polyester.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. Yeah. It's crazy. That was a real, inspiring moment for all collectors and really in terms of game worn jerseys right now, the market's never been hotter or higher for this kind of stuff. I mentioned earlier, I have 16 game worns.
Yeah.
The guys I talk to on some of these groups on Facebook and stuff like that, one guy's got a full basement, just like racks and racks. His kids play hide and go seek in the jerseys. That's how many he's got. Right? Like, it's just, it's incredible. He's got like hundreds. This one guy said to me on there, hey Stu, show me your collection. So I showed him all the pictures and I said, let me see your collection. He goes, well, I can't use this. I have to put it on Flickr. So that told me that it was lots. And it was like 73 jerseys and all like high, like Datsuk, like Iserman, like high end stuff. I'm like, I looked at this. I says, your collection must be worth like $150,000. He goes, well, closer to two, but you're close, right? I'm like, wow. You know, that's I look crazy. At mine and wow. mine's probably worth about 14, 13,000 in around there. But his is like, it's just astronomical. Like,
yeah.
These are heavy investments.
I mean, yeah, if you got that many and they're all, you know, big names, I wouldn't doubt that.
Yes.
I was shocked. We had Cam Connor on the show a few weeks ago, and Cam Connor was talking about how he played at the Celebrity, the Heritage Classic in 2003 with, you know, with Gretzky and all them, and had some fun doing that. But he was saying that at the game itself, and this is where I kind of went, oh, I'm kind of, I don't, that's kind of cheating, I guess. But he was saying that every period, Guy Lafleur and Wayne Gretzky would wear three jerseys apiece. Yeah. Every period, in order to be able to produce more game worn content, and I go, but they didn't. Absolutely. They didn't really wear them. They kind of just wore them over top of another jersey. Like, is there? Do you feel like? And again, I know that, you know, obviously it's a business, and everybody's, you know, there's people out there making serious money on this stuff. But do you feel like that kind of rarity then is kind of tossed to the wayside because somebody's out there trying to make, you know, trying to, instead of having three jerseys that these guys have worn now, one for each period, there's like 12, there's like 12 jerseys because they've worn four each period.
Exactly. It's kind of, you kind of know that it's a business and it's been watered down a bit. In terms of collecting, as long as it's, as there's the distinction is, the three distinctions for game worn are going to be preseason worn, game worn, and then playoff worn. Those are the three kind of different tiers, and then of course below that is game issued, but as long as it's game worn, today it still holds value, and you can buy a game worn. I bought a Toronto Maple Leaf Andropov game worn. And it's literally has, I think he wore it for like 12 games. It literally has no markings on it, but it's my gray, and I called my gray, and it's the real deal. So you get that, right? But that changed when collecting hockey jerseys became a thing. It really changed. I had a Builder Lego Leafs that I had for many, many years.
Yeah.
And this is from 1981. And it was just, I mean, it had stitch marks and holes and it was battered. It looked like his only road jersey for the whole season, maybe even two. And that really has some, you know, it's kind of neat looking. It's got the, you know, stitches in it and stuff like that. It's DNA, and it's really grimy, and I love that. Never wash it. But today it's a different thing. You'll see teams set one from, you know, 08 season, set two 08 season, set two of three of 09 season. So it's become different, and the teams are catering to it now.
I mean, you're a Leafs fan, Stu, and I mean,
I am indeed.
You've been on the show before, and we've talked to people, had some laughs about that. The history of the Leafs means there's like, you know, a gaggle of jerseys and sweaters that go back to the early 20th century. Are there any white whales that you're on the hunt for, so to speak? You know, like a jersey or a sweater where no matter the cost, you got to go in and try and get it.
You mean a Leaf one or anyone?
Anyone, but if there's a, I only brought up the Leafs because of the long history they have, so.
Yeah, probably I would be a very happy man and have a smile on my face if I could get a Cleveland Gilles Meloche.
Ooh.
Cleveland Barons.
Yeah.
Very, or a Walt McKechnie, extremely rare. Can't find them. Or something from the Kansas City Scouts. Like, you know, 5 years in the league, five years in existence in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Wilf Paymont, his number, that would be nice. Those things are just so rare, and you'd be billing up a lot of money. Like, you rarely see any of those ones. They're just that rare. McCreary Atlanta Flames would be nice. Some of those older ones. And you know, I wouldn't turn away a Daryl Sutler or Boris Salming, but they go for big dollars. They're out of my park. I think I saw a Salming go on an auction. It was just, I was glancing at early in the auction, it was up to 10 grand US. It was like, no thanks.
That's a lot of money. Again,
it's a lot of money, man. It's just crazy.
I was going to say, I was laughing again, going through some of this. Yari Curry, Colorado, fairly new, Colorado Avalanche, 97-98, you know, can't, has team repairs, all that kind of stuff on the classic auction site. Started at $400. It ended at $7,000, and it was more than the Joe Sakic Quebec Nordiques jersey. And I go, holy cow, like the rarity, I get the rarity of it, but like a Sakic one, I thought would go for way more just due to name. And it seems like Curry's got the lead on all these sort of players. I guess Curry, in terms of a name though, is one of those players where you're going to go, you're never going to get another one of those because he's never going to be around again.
Well, and the LA did a couple of interesting things. LA and Anaheim, they had a couple of times where they put their players in just a jersey that they only wore like for one or two games only. And one is the LA one. It's called the Burger King.
Yes.
And it's extremely, one of a curry of that is extremely rare. And they also did one with the Mighty Ducks had a picture of like a cartoonish duck on the front.
The Wild Wing, yeah.
The Wild Wing, those things are just—they come to auction. They're just astronomical, right? Guys will tease you on the sites. Look what I got today, and they'll put NFS on it, not for sale. It's like, oh, jeez, why do you even show it then?
Yeah, exactly. Why tease everybody? So
exactly.
Are you just a jersey guy, Stu? Would pucks, like if a Gretzky puck came up, for example, would you go after a Gretzky puck, or is it strictly a jersey thing?
No, it's for me. It's strictly a jersey thing, and strictly a game, just strictly game worn. I like all hockey memorabilia, but this is there's just something about a jersey that I don't know. I like it. It's just I wear them. I'll wear them in the wintertime when hockey season's on. I'll wear a different jersey. It just feels so good to know that some guy went out and gave his all in this thing. So it's kind of cool. I've bought and sold other hockey memorabilia. I've sold some stuff on Classic Auctions. Classic Auctions is great. I can't say enough about them. They get lots of exposure. I mean, they get you in the end with the 20%, because if you're selling on Classic Auctions, they also charge you 20%. That's the buyer's fee. So they make 40% of everything they sell by buying and selling. It's 20% either way. So yeah. So, but he also has to go around North America or, even Europe collecting all this stuff. So that's his business, but it's fun. It's just fun. And I all tell my friends, I say, listen, I'm in the hockey memorabilia business. Anything that you have, please don't ever think it doesn't have a value, because it may have a value. And I'll give you one quick example of this. I don't want to be too long winded.
No, it's okay.
A friend of mine was a real estate agent. He passed away in 2012, and a year before he passed away, he was in his garage. So Stuart got something for you. And I go, what's this? And he gave me this big old grocery bag, a paper grocery bag full of bottle caps. I'm like, what is this, Brent? Like, what's going on here? And they were Sprite caps, and on them were hockey players from the 64-65 season. Now, the old style bottle cap with the real cork inside.
Right, yeah.
And these were before they went on the bottle. So they still had the flange hadn't been pressed down on the bottle. Oh, okay. So there were no dents on the top. Now, they were in different shapes and stuff like that. So I says, how many are in here? And there was like 1,000 caps. I go, Brent, where did you get them? He goes, oh, I got them from a friend one time and I didn't think much of it. So I literally took this bag thinking, well, I got a bunch of bottle caps, no value, right? Stuck in my garage in a bag for 10 years. And then all of a sudden, I'm down at Can Central there on Aaron and Wellington.
Okay.
And I see a couple of these caps he's got in a display. And there was like, it's like kind of no-name guys for like $8 a cap, $10 a cap. I'm like, God, if this is $8 and I have 1,000, do I have $8,000? Well, who knows? Anyways, I started sorting these. Six teams, 18 players on a team, 108 caps makes the whole league back then. And I had a set, so I called the guy, Mark, from Classic Auctions. I says, took a picture of it. I says, you think you can sell these? He goes, yeah, send them in. I sent them in. Trevor, I got $1,500 US for 108 bottle caps.
What?
I kid you not.
That is awesome.
I've sold three sets since. Now, I don't have any full sets left, but I still have 700 caps in my closet right now. So something that I, as a collector, thought was junk. That's why I always caution people, don't think it's junk, because it may not be. I've made probably about almost $6,000 Canadian off these bottle caps so far. And I'm not done with them yet. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, 700 bottle caps. You still got a long way to go. Like, that's got a long way to go. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I've got, Bellevaux, Henri Richard, Gordie Howe, like all the guys from the mid-60s, right?
From way back. I mean, some of that memorabilia, like I said, I mean, yeah, you're right. It looks like junk at the time. And then, 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, it's like people are willing to spend an arm and a leg to get it. So I agree with you. Don't throw anything away if it looks like it has value. That's for sure, folks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do not. Especially if it's got a picture of a hockey player on it, it's probably going to have a value. Yeah.
I'm going to give you a bit of a soapbox here, Stu, as we sort of get close to time for this segment anyway.
Sure.
I don't know if people know how to get in or what to do to get in. I know we talked a little bit about it, but where do people go to learn about this stuff? Like, where are their sites? Like, should they just go to the auction sites and sort of keep an eye on stuff? Are there people they should be talking to? Where's the best place or where's a good place to start if I'm interested in maybe doing this for a side venture?
Sure. What a lot of people do is they'll get on Facebook and they'll type in game worn hockey jerseys, game worn hockey group, and they'll just come in there and say, "Hi guys, I'm new to this. I want to get my first jersey. Tell me what to look for and give me an idea." And then these guys come flooding and helping. Right? They're great. They just want to help so badly. And then they'll probably send you off to some auctions. They'll probably send you off, have a look at some of the different site stuff that sells on the sites, because there's always stuff for sale. Or they'll send you to eBay as well. And you can have a look there. If you go into eBay and just type in game worn NHL jerseys, there's usually probably 400 or 500 that come up at any given time. Now, they're all over the place, price-wise, of course. But you can make an offer. I've done that before, make an offer on something and bought. So, yeah, there's lots of places to start. And you can actually probably go to library and look up different articles on collecting and stuff like that. Old Hockey News are great. They used to have articles on collecting. So there's a few places to go. And there's also a few guys in Winnipeg. I'm certainly not one of the bigger ones, but there's a guy named Pat Lelliott who is also a collector, and he's got a huge, huge, extensive, or did have anyways, Jets memorabilia. So he's also a good guy in the city to get a hold of, and he's on Facebook as well. So yeah, if you with the internet and Facebook, it's easy to find places to go and easy to not start off and not get fleeced like I did back in 98.
Yeah. Try not to get fleeced, everybody. That's a good piece of advice there. But Stu, I mean, I can't say thanks enough for coming on here. I'm going to keep watching for stuff. Obviously, if you have,
Sure.
Is there any auction you know of that's coming up that you want to point out, or anything you want to point out, anything you want to promote before we let you get out of here?
A few have been put on hold. Classic goes 3 times a year. Game Worn put theirs off until October, and you see stuff on the forums about guys doing some expositions and stuff like that, but they've been put off a little bit for COVID too. They're just kind of starting up again. So there are places to go, and there's a few places in the city here in Winnipeg. But yeah, it's just start searching, and then the whole world will open up to you.
I know the U.S. has conventions where they have like game worn jersey conventions and stuff.
Big.
Would you like to see something like that come to Winnipeg, for example?
I think there was actually a small one last year. I didn't attend, but I'd love to see something like that. Yeah, I'd love to see that, especially if you get some Jets players out and stuff like that. That'd be fun.
Yeah,
because I love the old Jet stuff. I love goals for kids. I mean, that old. I'd love to get an old Jet stuff, but it goes for a good price now. They know what to charge for it now.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing, is that, you know, the rarity and certainly the hard to get factor is always going to be in there. So, Stu, I have learned more than I learned in reading for 2 days about this stuff. So in this last 30 minutes that we've talked, so I want to say thank you for coming on. By all means, we're going to do this again at some point, because I know with all the new jerseys that come out and all the new designs that are coming out next 2 or 3 years with the third jerseys coming out, things are going to get a little bit more rare for some of the teams out there. So I'm sure we'll have another chat coming up in the near future, and we'll go over some more of your collection and everything else that's happening.
Look forward to it.
That is awesome. Thank you, Stu. And everybody keep their eyes on the auction site. Certainly go over to Facebook, as Stu said, and get in there if you want. We'll be right back after this message, folks. Stay tuned here on The Hockey Show.
David, what do you suggest we play?
I don't care. Anything. I would rather watch Beautician and the Beast. I would rather listen to Fran Drescher for 8 hours than have to listen to Michael McDonald. Nothing against him, but if I hear Yamo be there one more time, I'm going to Yamo burn this place to the ground.
Such a smartass. Get back on the floor.
You're listening to 101.5 CJUMFM. Hey everybody, welcome back to The Hockey Show here on 101.5 UMFM, Canada's only campus-produced radio show, strictly talking hockey. Glad to have you along again. I want to thank Stu Eckert for coming on, Stu, with some great information about some game-worn jerseys and obviously all the stuff that he's involved with. If you're interested, again, get over to Facebook, get over to some of the auction sites, do a little pricing, see what you got maybe in your closet and what may be worth some stuff. That's always good to see. Looking at some of the other hockey stories that have come out now, surprisingly, I made this revelation the other day on Hockey Blog in Canada. I thought that Vancouver would be a fantastic hub city for the NHL's restart. I know that there's a ton of concern right now with all of the cases that are happening in the U.S. and the whole Tampa Bay situation, where they had a number of players and staff test positive, the Austin Matthews situation where he tested positive. It seemed like Vancouver was on the right track. They numbers are going down. BC's done a great job in trying to reduce the spread of the virus. They've done an outstanding you know, job just in terms of being a major international hub for a lot of flights and a lot of travelers, where they have reduced their numbers considerably. At least I thought they did. Back on March 15, 2020, it was reported that the Canucks had a full-time staff member who tested positive for COVID-19. Since that time, though, nobody else has been reported within the Canucks community of having the virus. Everything looked good. They're one of the three remaining, or they're one of the three Canadian cities, one of the six remaining hub cities that the NHL is considering. But Elliot Friedman brought up an interesting point yesterday that there might be a problem with Vancouver in that the contingency plans of a player test positive might be the new hurdle for Vancouver. Now, I was surprised by this because I thought, hey, Vancouver's got themselves a good setup. They have Rogers Place downtown. There are a bunch of hotels down there. Shouldn't be much of a problem. But it seems that there's a concern about the bubble that would be created in Vancouver and how they would separate players who are positive, who test positive, from the rest of the community without compromising the entire community. And I'm shocked by this. I thought this would be something that the NHL and Vancouver would have already, or at least Vancouver would have had hammered out, but it seems like it's not. And now the NHL might have to go back and reconsider their plans for Vancouver. According to reports by both Chris Johnson and Elliot Friedman, Las Vegas is still the front runner. Las Vegas, with the number of COVID-19 cases in Arizona and California and Nevada going up, not as bad, although they seem to be on the borders of those two incredibly dangerous states right now in Arizona and California. But Nevada, the reason that Las Vegas is still on the map is because the MGM Grand, where most of those players would be staying, and the surrounding areas basically can create their own bubble. There's a lot of room for a lot of other hotels that can be used to segregate players if they have to be segregated without, you know, breaking that whole bubble quarantine area that they're going to have set up for the NHL players. So it looks like Vegas might be still the front runner for the NHL, which is baffling to me considering everything that went on. Los Angeles yesterday posted the highest number of new cases in history, in their state's history. So I would say probably Los Angeles is out of the running right now. So for those that aren't keeping track, the six final cities are Toronto, Edmonton, Vancouver in Canada, three cities in the States, Chicago, which again I don't think is going to work very well, but Chicago, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas, with Las Vegas being the front runner still. Chicago and L.A. got a lot of work to do. L.A. probably just eliminated themselves. And it sounds like with the mask situation that's going to happen in Los Angeles to prevent spreading, it's no longer going to be a Los Angeles summer for a lot of these guys that are looking to play hockey. So that would leave Vegas as one of the two cities. And it sounds like if they're going to do an east-west split, which I think is the smartest thing to do, much like they do for Hockey Night in Canada, much like Sportsnet is doing and CBC has done in the past, the wise thing would be a Toronto-Vancouver split or a Toronto-Vegas split. I thought Toronto-Vancouver would make sense because, again, it works out so well in that the Western teams would have to, and this is the weird thing, though, because the NHL has already said that the home team, the team that the city that gets picked as the hub, their home team can't play there. Which would mean the West play in Toronto, because Vegas can't play there, and if Vegas is going to be in the Western Conference of the playoffs, that's how it's going to work. So if Toronto and Vegas were the two cities, the Western Conference would play out of Toronto, and the Eastern Conference would play out of Vegas. I know that right now, like, you're trying to wrap your head around that, but the way it looks is that these two cities might make the most sense. Now, Toronto obviously makes a ton of sense because there's a major broadcaster in Sportsnet right there. I get that. Like, I understand that. Vegas makes a lot of sense, just, again, due to health setup. But Toronto's got tons of room downtown with the ACC and all the hotels around there. Like, it's not going to be that much of a problem. The weird thing that I found, not weird, I guess, but probably one of the coolest things that I found. If you know me, I've been against this NHL restart from the beginning.
I think that they're putting players' lives at risk. I think that they're putting families' lives at risk. I think that they're putting... It's too much of a risk for these players when we got a bigger picture to consider if we're going to start up in the fall, sometime in the fall, whenever they plan on doing it. They're expecting to finish this season sometime around... the games are supposed to start sometime in August. August 1st is what they're aiming for, it sounds like. That means if they go 3 months, August, September, October, we wouldn't have games then probably until either December or January for the new NHL season. Which, baffling, number one. Number two, just crazy in terms of trying to slam together two seasons, the end of one season and the beginning of another season. But hey, whatever, I'm not in charge. But the weird thing that I found, and probably the most relieving thing that I found, is that Vancouver NHL fans, Vancouver hockey fans, have voted against their city being a hub city. They don't want the NHL there. Now, you could probably say 100, you know, give it 100 reasons why, but they legitimately have said they are proud of their efforts in reducing the numbers of COVID-19, and they want to continue that by not including NHL players as invites to their city. This makes total sense to me. I mean, we've seen what happened in baseball when, you know, all those guys went down to Florida, Phillies, Blue Jays, and a bunch of them tested positive. We've seen what happened with the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Arizona Coyotes. We've seen what happened in the NCAA with all the football teams and all those guys getting sick. I'm proud of you, Vancouver. I'm proud of Vancouver for the fans anyway, for standing up and saying, we don't want this. I get the health risks. And a lot of you are going to say, well, Teeves, like, that's just being ridiculous. Like, everybody wants the NHL. Yeah, everybody does, but nobody's going to be able to go see it. Everybody's going to watch it at home on TV. Does it matter where it's played? If public health is priority number one for your government, your local government, why would you want this? Edmonton's on its own, walk to its own beat of its own drum. They're just out there advocating for every single NHL event to come to that city. Toronto hasn't said a peep. They're just sort of keeping their mouth shut right now. Vegas is golden as per the NHL's rule, and Vancouver's going, nah. We appreciate the honor of being one of the finalists, but nah, no thanks. We're not interested. There's still a lot to go over, and I think the NHL players are going to have a big say in what happens and where this, if this actually happens, where it goes, what happens with it. But I want to give full credit to the people of Vancouver for saying no. It takes some guts to say that. Don't get me wrong. It takes some guts to say no to the NHL. But these people are actually standing up and going, not worth it. Not worth it. A Twitter poll the other day had nearly 49% of respondents saying, nah, we don't want it here. 49%, that's half the poll. It's overwhelmingly the majority of the three options that were presented. A number of their forums, their Vancouver Canuck chat boards and forums that they have all said the same thing. We don't care. We don't want it here. I fully respect that. And you know what? I'm proud of Vancouver for saying that, for standing up and saying that. Vancouver fans, you guys are all right. I know you rioted after your Stanley Cup loss there to the Bruins. I know that didn't go over well for a lot of people, but you guys are smart. You guys are doing the right thing here. As much as the NHL wants to go and play in your city, or may want to go play in your city, I think you guys have made the right choice. So we'll see what happens. The hub cities have not been decided yet, obviously, but if it's Vegas and Toronto, good luck with that. If it's Vancouver who gets selected, well, you have to deal with the fallout when that happens, but it seems like Chicago, Edmonton, and Los Angeles right now are the extreme long shots to get in there. So it might be a pretty good choice that there's going to be a Canadian city at least as one of the hub cities. Speaking of Toronto, Hockey Hall of Fame is there. I want to congratulate the new inductees for the 2020 Hall of Fame inductee class. It's Jerome Iginla, Marian Hossa, Doug Wilson, Kevin Lowe, Kim St. Pierre, Ken Holland. Are the Ken Holland going in as a builder? Are the 2020 Hall of Fame inductees? Now, I'm not against any of those players. Like, Iginla, you can make every single argument against. The dude was just a great dude, stood up for his country all the time, went to the Olympics, was vitally important, assisted on that Canada goal in 2010 with Sidney Crosby. You can't say enough good things about Aguinaldo. Didn't win a Stanley Cup, but dude was one of the best, and everybody has said that. He's legitimately one of the nicest guys going around, and I think that speaks volumes to helping him get in. Marian Hossa, great player, fantastic work, lot of points in the NHL, a little less shine on the star there in terms of what he's done and the number of accolades he's accumulated. Doug Wilson, a bit of a head scratcher, but considering his entire breadth of work, both as a player and as a manager, I get it. Not a problem. Same thing with Ken Holland. Ken Holland more as a manager than a player, but he was in the NHL, played in the NHL for a while. I get that. Kim St. Pierre, again, gold medalist, three-time gold medalist, five-time IIHF World Championship gold medalist. She's done it all in women's hockey. One of the best goaltenders ever to have played the game. And Kevin Lowe, who won 6 Stanley Cups, although may not even be the best defender going in this year, when you consider some of the players that are still on the board. But you can't overlook the fact that he was a leader. He was important to the Edmonton Oilers organization. He's the first NHL goal by an Oiler. He was the first draft pick. He, again, won 6 Stanley Cups in his time in the NHL. There might be better options for that, but that's why we're here. That's why we get to sit here and maybe dissect some of the stuff that the NHL overlooks when it comes to this voting option. So I want to ask why a guy, I'm going to go to bat for him. Met him, fantastic guy, outstanding individual. I want to go to bat for Reggie Leach. Reggie Leach should be in the NHL hockey, in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Now, people can say whatever they want about Reggie Leach in terms of, oh, he didn't, Stanley Cup, it's just your guy, in terms of setting up the Broad Street Bullies. That's Bobby Clark. Reggie Leach, McLeish, those guys, they were all there, Barber. But let's be honest. I'm going to say no. I think Reggie Leach should be in the Hockey Hall of Fame. I mean, take birthrights alone. Having Reggie Leach go in as an Aboriginal, as an Indigenous player, is something that should have happened a long time ago, based upon his abilities. He's part of the Hockey Hall of Fame, the Manitoba Hockey Hall of Fame, where he was inducted in 1985. He's part of the Manitoba Sports Hall of Fame in 1997. He was inducted in the Philadelphia Flyers Hall of Fame in 1992. Like, let's not make anything about this other than the fact that there should be some recognition to Reggie Leach's abilities. Some of the stuff that he's done. The Riverton Rifle deserves to be in the Hockey Hall of Fame, maybe more so than a few others. He is the only player, the first and only player, who was a non-goalie to win the Conn Smythe Trophy while not playing on the winning team. Did that in 1976. That alone is something that will never be done again. He was the first player to have that bestowed upon him. Second team All-Star in 76, NHL All-Star in both 76 and 80. He has a Stanley Cup ring from 75. He was a member of the 76 Canada Cup team. Scored the most goals in 75-76 with 61 in leading the Flyers to their Stanley Cup appearance that year. 934 games, 381 goals, 285 assists. Now, the point total might be where people go, he didn't have enough points. Didn't score enough goals. Again, we're talking about a guy who was one of the most prolific scorers in the Western Junior Hockey League with the Flin Flon Bombers. We're talking about a guy who legitimately helped the Flyers win a Stanley Cup, or maybe a couple Stanley Cups. We're talking about a guy that has represented Canada on the international stage. We're talking about a guy who likely was viewed as the best goal scorer in his time at one point. And Reggie Leach isn't in there yet. I mean, the stuff that he's done after hockey is simply remarkable as well. He was given an honorary PhD by Brock University. He's worked hard to bring the game to Indigenous communities. He's a phenomenal man that should be in the NHL, or should be in the Hockey Hall of Fame, for his contributions to the game of hockey. But he's not. I'm on the Reggie Leach Hockey Hall of Fame bandwagon. In fact, I might be pulling it, because I think that he deserves to be in there. On the women's side, let's just be honest, the Hockey Hall of Fame has done an injustice in not nominating more women. I can give you an armful of names right now, such as Julie Chu, Jennifer Botterill, Manon Rayon. Three off the top of my head, there's probably more. No arguing what Manon Rayon did in terms of elevating the women hockey players across the world with her. I mean, again, it was a marketing stunt. Let's not cut it anyway, but what it is, Tampa Bay Lightning experiment was a marketing stunt. But she played in the IHL and she played in the ECHL and made an impact. Was a good player, a decent player out there. Didn't win a bunch of gold medals with Canada long before her time in terms of what she did. But she was on a different track. Manon Rayon deserves a nod, if for nothing else, by being a trailblazer. Jennifer Botterill, her career with the Canadian national team, probably unmatched in terms of a lot of the stuff that she did. Julie Chu, for her work on the blue line for the Americans, should probably be in. And now her work with the Concordia Stingers absolutely deserves a little bit of a nod there. Again, Botterill working as a broadcaster now with the New York Islanders as well. Like, their contributions to hockey have been immense, if not groundbreaking. I don't know. There's opportunities still to have a lot of people go in, a lot of good people go in, and the fact that the Hall keeps overlooking certain people and certain players, certain genders, just because of whatever reason. And again, take nothing away from this year's class. Iginla, solid. Hossa, great point totals. Wilson and Lowe may be a little less impressive. St. Pierre, absolutely deserving for her work in the Canadian crease. And then Ken Holland, his work in building that Red Wings franchise for the longest time, certainly, and then his work with, you know, Team Canada, certainly deserves a nod as well. But this Hockey Hall of Fame induction committee has got to get their act together and start really looking at some of these players who have changed the way that hockey is played for specific groups of people, and in the way that it's played when talking about certain achievements that have been reached. An Indigenous person in Reggie Leach, the women in terms of Chu and Botterill and Rayon, these players can't be overlooked anymore. We need to start paying attention to all hockey, because that's what the Hockey Hall of Fame represents, all of hockey. And that's where we'll leave it for this week, folks, as we got to get out of here. Skippy coming up right away with Free Range Radio here on the Mothership. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, to the Hockey Show. Make sure you tune in next week. Another great guest coming on as we get set for another great show next Thursday here on 101.5 UMFM.